Ever wonder if there's more to the movies you love? Do you like to ponder how they got from A to Z? Who chose the plot twists? Why use those characters? Is there a deeper meaning? We're here to explore those questions and maybe learn a bit along the way. VGB Studios proudly presents The Filmlosophers.
Hello and welcome to another exciting episode of The Filmlosophers, the show that gets into the movies you love and digs a little deeper. I am your host, Eddie Villanueva, and alongside me, as always, is Sir Chad Riley.
Why, hello. If I'm a sir, I must speak with a British accent.
Never mind, we'll drop the sir.
Thank you.
Also with us is, I almost called you another Chad. Chad number two, otherwise known as Spencer Williams.
I'm going to be leaving soon if this keeps up.
Oh, this
Spencer,
is great.
I appreciate you enough. I would loan you my name if the need ever arose. Why it would arise, I don't know.
Chad number two.
Well, thanks, Chad.
There you go. Mm. We got a great show in store for you today as we are reviewing a recent film at the box offices, 12 Strong. It seems to be getting a lot of buzz lately in terms of talks and reviews, so we're going to throw our hat in the ring and give it a go. So
it's going to be fun.
There it is.
Ish. And meaningful. And deep.
Okay.
All right, why don't I hit people with the opening credits and keep going? The Filmlosophers is a brilliant podcast full of lots of great information and talk from guys who know what they're talking about. Sometimes we're presented by Mingle Media TV and recorded live each week at VGB Studios. Our entire library of episodes can be found on Audio Boom, Stitcher, iTunes, Google Play, Libsyn, and Player FM, and some other places too. I'm sure new episodes debut each Wednesday. Spencer, where can people find us other than in our library?
Hey, you can find us on Facebook at facebook.com/filmlosophers. Or you can follow us on Twitter at twitter.com/filmlosophy101. Also, you can check out our previous episodes at filmlosophers.com.
That's right, we got a website!
Finally! It only took 2 years.
Honestly, I'm just so excited that now we can actually use our... Okay, I take this back. Not that we can actually, but we finally realized that we should start using the URL that we're paying for.
Again, we're intelligent sometimes.
Hey, we'll get there.
It took us 2 years to realize, hey, you know that URL that we've owned the entire time? We should probably use that instead of the studio URL. Hey,
we got the smarts.
Baby steps. You know, you took 2 years. You're a toddler.
Exactly.
There we go. Now we're in our terrible twos.
Oh, no, we forgot to turn on the mics. No, I'm just kidding. Oh, yes. We are coming out of it. So, like we said, we saw a film this weekend called 12 Strong. It's a film that really isn't in the norm in terms of talks. I know we've been actually talking about awards movies and things of that sort, but this is the type of film where we decided to take a little break away from that to talk about this particular piece because it seems to be another piece of history, if you will.
Yeah, another much more
unknown,
recent.
Yeah, and another unknown piece of history, as that seems to be the theme of the last couple of months, realizing movies that are talking about parts of history that we either had no clue or weren't given the information for.
I know, I learned a lot from Thor Ragnarok.
It's true. Yeah.
Sorry, I only bring it up because Chris Hemsworth is in both.
I got you. I got you.
No, but I mean, that's a thing in Hollywood, right? Is to find those hopefully hidden gems, those stories that people might not know all about it or anything about it, and you know, kind of polish it up and put it out there and see if people kind of catch the vibe.
True. Very true. Chad, why don't you hit us with that synopsis?
Sure. In the wake of September 11th, specifically the attacks on September 11th, 2001, Captain Mitch Nelson leads a U.S. Special Forces team into Afghanistan for an extremely dangerous mission. Once there, the soldiers develop an uneasy partnership with the Northern Alliance to take down the Taliban and its al-Qaeda allies. Outgunned and outnumbered, Nelson and his forces face overwhelming odds in a fight against a ruthless enemy that takes no prisoners.
Directed by Nikolai Foljasig. Try to say that one five times fast. The film stars, as we said, Chris Hemsworth, Michael Shannon, Michael Pena, Navid Naganban, William Fichtner, Rob Riggle, and many others. Rob Riggle just seems like a fun name. It's like, I bet he woke up, I'm going to be an actor. What should my name be? Rob Riggle. That just... I'm having.
You know, I mean, I'll go with you on this. I don't know that it's a stage name. I mean, I think it's his given name.
I know,
isn't it?
But it just seems so like, I don't know. It seems like one of those names where you're like, that can't really be your name. No. What's your real name? It's David, right? David Johnson. Nope, it's Rob Riggle. I was born Rob Riggle.
You spent a lot of time thinking about this.
Leave the man alone. He's only trying to entertain you.
The film, which began production back in 2016, is based off of the 2010 novel Horse Soldiers by author Doug Stanton. I'm sorry,
were
but
you about to say Horse Shoulders?
Oi. I don't know. We might need to go back to the beginning on this one, folks.
Oh, my gosh.
There's no recovering from that. Horse shoulders.
It was a combination of just me reading that right from the laptop and having watched Indiana Jones and the Last Crusades and thinking of Sean Connery. We're off the book from Horse Shoulders.
Oh, my gosh.
Wow, y'all.
Oh, this is going to be a long one.
It's going to be a good one. Horse shoulders.
Horse shoulders.
So actually, horse soldiers.
I did it to myself.
We don't drink on the podcast. I feel like somebody needs to say that.
I'm drinking tea. Does that count?
Apparently, I don't know what you've done to the tea.
So, like we said... The film just debuted this past weekend in wide release theaters all around. And like we said, this is a film that kind of chronicles the execution of a covert mission that happened, honestly, weeks.
They began just a couple weeks after.
Okay. Then that was correct. Weeks right after the events of 9/11 and pretty much went full-fledged into the heart of Afghanistan, if you will. Obviously it was a very charged and emotional time for the nation at, for the events that had happened. And so this was essentially the first response from America.
Right.
And rightly so. I mean, obviously if you're from overseas, you may have heard about it on the radio or on the TV, or you may have, heard about it in passing. It was a really big event, obviously. But here in North America, in the United States,
you're talking about September 11th itself.
September 11th itself.
The events of not many people knew that this happened. It was a covert operation, but yeah, you're talking about the actual
inciting incident,
attack,
I guess, if you will.
Yeah.
Which the film does begin that way. It does start out with the day of incident, and it's one of those things where it's very fresh for a lot of people, even still today, because of the fact of how much of an impact that incident had, not only in the lives of Americans, but also in the impact of how we as a military power respond to situations now.
Sure.
So this film really kind of gives us a glimpse into that first initial step of what would become, Operation...
Task Force Dagger.
Task Force Dagger.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So, like I said, we went to go see this film, and... We essentially weren't talking about it right after the film, but once we sat down and began to eat some chimichangas and whatnot, and we're,
which is a really appropriate thing to do after seeing a film like this. I mean, you go eat some chimichangas. And...
Exactly. I honestly didn't think, and obviously this is all off-air stuff conversation that we had, but hopefully we'll bring it to this table here. I really didn't think it was going to charge up a conversation as much as it did between the three of us, as well as the other individuals that were at the table, as it did. Like, I was actually surprised as to how much each one of us drew out of this film and were able to speak towards it.
And it definitely is a film that on the surface of it, you see it and you think, okay, well, it's a war situation. Everybody's familiar. I mean, presumably, basically, everybody's familiar with the inciting incident.
Yeah.
The September 11th terror attacks. And so you take that and then you look into a military response. And, you've got obviously fighting, bombs, guns, whatever. and you get some sort of either progress or lack thereof, and then you have a result at the end. And you could easily say, okay, well, it was a war movie, and it was either good or bad. You know, I either liked it or I didn't as a war movie. But then because of how recent these events are, obviously none of the three of us, as we covered in our previous episode on The Post, none of us were around for the Vietnam War era or the immediate aftermath thereof. And so a lot of the information that was presented in that film, Steven Spielberg directed, a lot of the information that they assumed that you might know, we didn't, because we're a little bit too young to have name recognition knowledge. But for this film, 12 Strong, we definitely didn't need a primer.
No, not at all.
What situation we're talking about, even some of the village names in Afghanistan, we have heard, you know, years ago, obviously, on the nightly news or whatever, as reporters were saying, here's where the war on terror is taking place over there. There was a lot more familiarity with this, which I think opened up some opportunities for us, like you mentioned afterward. Yeah. We did have some connecting points that are not directly, here's what the movie presented us with,
no,
but here's what our kind of life experience radar pinged on the map, supplemental to the movie, the story that's in the movie.
I know this is kind of a off question, I guess, but Spence, where were you at when the events of this were happening? Like, were you in school? Were you...
Okay, so for the September 11th thing, I was actually just waking up, and this is gonna sound terrible, but like I saw what was happening on like the TV, and like I had just woken up, so I didn't quite fully understand what the gravity. I thought it was just Fox and some stupid special, like when buildings fall down or something ridiculous. Mm. I was like, this doesn't even belong.
Are you talking about like when animals attack?
Yeah,
too.
I remember when they had terrible TV shows like that.
They still do.
Yeah, but they had it more, I feel like.
It's all in their news channels.
Oh, gosh.
Oy.
So anyway.
Now we're going to get letters of complaint. Eddie, just go back to your horse shoulders. Oh, boy.
Okay, so anyway.
Spencer, you woke up, you saw it, you didn't know that it was news coverage of an actual world event.
Yeah, I thought it was just something stupid.
Like a stadium implosion or something,
yeah,
but it happened
like
to be a skyscraper.
Yeah.
Interesting.
What about you, Chad?
Well, as I've mentioned before, I'm from the Midwest, I'm from Indiana, so I was in the same time zone as, you know, when these events were happening. I was a freshman in college, and I remember most of the time I was not necessarily up early enough to turn on things like the Today Show. On that particular day, I happened to be up early, and I thought, I wonder what's going on in the world today. And I turned on the TV, and the Today Show was on, and only one of the planes had hit at that point.
Oh, wow.
And they were still reporting. So I watched things beyond that point unfold in real time on TV, and I remember... the school, my university that I was attending, they canceled classes almost immediately, and they set up live stream, large screen news feeds all over the campus so that you could go to see it. Because obviously, I happened to have a television in my dorm room.
Yeah.
Several students didn't, and many students were from other parts of the world, including New York City. Or Pennsylvania, or you know, wherever, you know, places that were more directly involved in what was going on than, you know, in the middle of a few cornfields in Indiana. But I remember watching literally everything. Like we watched it the whole entire day.
Yeah.
You know, just shocked and dumbfounded in horror. Like everything from the second plane hitting to the buildings collapsing and the wall of dust. Like the sandstorm, like, you know, concrete particles and whatever else was flying at people. And then people trying to just like evacuate on foot over the bridges and all of it. I distinctly remember a lot of the happenings of that day as shown on TV. Obviously, I wasn't there.
Yeah, no. And that's interesting. It's odd for me because I was walking into school as, you know, the events were unfolding, and as I was going up the stairs to get to my classrooms, it was kind of like one of those unique movie scenes where, like, the person is walking and everyone else is watching TV and you don't know what they're watching because the TV is away from, you know, any windows or whatnot, but everybody's fixated on one point in the room. And I finally get to homeroom and I'm like, I think everybody's watching TV downstairs. And they finally all let me know, like, what was going on. And essentially, in the same aspect of what you had experienced with school, every single classroom was focused on one of the largest classrooms, because at the time we only had one TV, and so they put the one TV in the largest classroom, and it was packed out with students as well as teachers and faculty.
You were in high school at this
point?
I
was still in high school.
Yeah. I mean, I know our age difference. I just didn't know if you would have been in high school or still, like, ending middle school.
Thanks.
I was trying to backwards calculate.
Wow. Yeah, so...
I mean, I could easily be calling myself old.
You could. But I took offense to it first. You can't have it.
Okay, fine.
No, jeez. So...
you can keep your offense.
The interesting aspect, though, was that being in San Antonio, at the time, San Antonio was one of the biggest areas, aside from the major known ones, for having Air Force bases in it. So immediately after that, the governor of Texas had issued a statement on the local channels stating that, you know, to make sure you're on high alert, that if you're near an Air Force base, to be aware of the air sirens, the raid sirens that they
sure, yeah,
this piercing loud sound that comes from one of the Air Force bases, to let people know that the possibility of the city getting hit next was a big likelihood.
Yeah, there was a lot of uncertainty about what was happening that day and what other things might happen either that day or in the immediate following days, as everyone was frantically trying to figure out what's going on and what we can do about it.
Yeah. And I think that kind of, to transition back to the film, it's interesting how this film, obviously it chronicles from that moment on through to the covert mission that they, you know, go out and do. That first 15, 20 minutes of the film is it brought back for me a lot of that, you know, memory in terms of just feelings and whatnot. But before we get into that, let's talk about impressions. I know you were one of the big proponents to seeing this film. In fact, I think this was at the top of your list for seeing it. I'm not going to lie. I really was unaware of what the premise of the film was, other than I knew it had to do with horses, because that's what was in the trailer, and it was a war film, and it was something, it had something to do with 9/11. That was about it.
Sure. I remember seeing one of the early trailers, and I believe, like, obviously, I have never served in the military. I have tremendous respect for those who have and those who do, and I find those types of stories very compelling. I think that especially when they are centered on a historic event, like an actual real world event, or they're based on a true story, as this one is, I always find them compelling, even if the movies are poorly done. I think that the idea of telling these stories, these kind of, like, on the front lines, in a Hollywoodized, I won't say glamorized, because many of them are not glamorized, but in a Hollywoodized version of real life events, you know, I find those to be very compelling. And I remember that in that first trailer that I saw, not only did it have the title, but also the subtitle of the film, which I don't remember exactly how it works, but it's basically the declassified true story of the horse soldiers, you know, in Afghanistan or whatever. And so that also, I enjoy watching war movies, and I really enjoy spy movies, or, like, covert, you know, secret information movies. I don't know how exactly to say that. And so this one had both. It seemed to me, by the way the subtitle worked, that this one had both components, and I was excited to see it.
Spence, I know we've talked about how Chad has a thing for not enjoying horror films, because of his own personal reasons. What is your take on war films?
Oh, gosh.
Yeah.
War films are not really my favorite, especially ones that are, well, it's mostly ones that are centered around real events, because, you know, both my dad and my grandfather were in the military, and, you know, I've spent time with my grandfather going to see veterans in the hospital, and it just bugs me sometimes, like, how we treat our veterans as a country. Like, some of them are homeless, or some of them aren't being taken care of. And, like, when you see, films like this, and, like, you have Hollywood making, like, a lot of money off of their pain and suffering, it just kind of bugs me. Like, and it makes it hard for me to really get into these films versus other films.
What were you expecting out of this one before we had came in? While we were sitting down in the theater, before the lights went down, what were the things that you were expecting out of this film? The typical, or actually something unique?
Oh gosh, that's a hard question to answer. It's kind of, I was kind of more not expecting anything and just bracing myself for my onslaught of thoughts that were just going to be firing off during the movie. And there were a lot of them, especially about a certain Donald Rumsfeld.
Who does make a cameo in the movie. I shouldn't say that. He's not. There's archival footage.
Yeah, it's more footage.
He doesn't actually make a cameo. I should.
Hey,
no,
y'all, I'm back in the film for just this. I don't know how he sounds, honestly. And that's the thing. When it comes to most war films, in still talking about expectations, there are certain like similarities that you tend to see with most of them. You know, the leader of the pack, you know, goes out bravely with his troops. Something happens to some of them. He still bravely carries out the mission, comes home, and everything's back, you know, to normal. In most cases, which I think that kind of speaks, Spencer, to what you're saying in terms of how certain war films are glamorized, or even the mere idea of war is sometimes glamorized.
Right.
Sure.
And so, in this particular film, that was something of a afterthought for me. Coming into, because I'm in Spencer, I am nowhere near in terms of like the amount of thought that you put into your mindset behind the genre. But for me, it's always more logistical when I look at films. And for me, not much like how I look at horror films, because horror films for me, much like how B movies for Spencer, can do no wrong in my eyes. So I know that there's similarities in most films and the cyclical reasoning and logic that happens that makes no sense. But for most other films, I have no problem turning on the pro cap and saying, okay, so logistically, if this film is going to fall into the same vein as other war films, there are certain markers that they always hit. They establish the head leader point. They establish the, you know, point of authority that he adheres to. They establish the long haul, whatnot. There's usually a formula, if you will. I think that's the word I'm looking for. There's usually a formula, and that's what was in the back of my mind, is wondering if I can kind of pinpoint and find a lot of those little things, because it's been seen. I mean, it's been done several times over.
Yeah, I mean, there's definitely something to be said for, and it happens in any film, but there's you have sort of the literal landscape, like the setting, the canvas of the film, but you also have the landscape of the story.
Yeah.
And you've got to have some key elements in there. And depending on the genre, those elements can be different. But I mean, a war film, you've got to have your heroes. You've got to have at least one major villain. And you've got to have, beyond the military conflict, oftentimes you need to set up some interpersonal conflicts, either with the chain of command or with your associates in the field. Or, as in this case, even with family back home.
Yeah. And that, well, let's just jump into the movie. We can kind of get into a little bit of that. So, obviously, like we said, the film centers around the covert mission of this group of, 12 American soldiers, as they team up with a warlord, if you will, militia leader.
Yeah, so they've got hundreds of troops that are sent to Uzbekistan, and then within that hundreds of troops grouping, there are numerous cadres of smaller groups of special operatives, in this case Green Berets, And so, yeah, there are 12 members of this group, and five cadres of like small parcels, if you will, volunteer for this job. And the group that we're following in the movie is the group that is selected first of those five options to go and interact with, basically embed with the local militias, and provide tactical information to U.S. air support to heavily bomb stronghold areas so that the militias can then execute ground tactics against the Taliban.
And this is where you have the makings of the core of your cast, if you will. Chris Hemsworth, obviously, is in this film. He plays the captain of the team, Mitch Nelson. You have Michael Shannon, who plays... I'm not sure what...
His last name is Spencer, which I wondered, Spencer, how you felt. You know, because I always noticed there are other guys named Chad, but there aren't too many people. It's not like Tom or John or, you know, Henry or something like... Yeah. So I always notice when it's my name that somebody's saying. So I was sitting there a couple times wondering how you felt.
No, it's the same feeling for me too. Because like when they said Spencer, I was like, wait, what's his name? Because I don't remember hearing that before in the movie. I'm still not even sure what his full name is.
Yeah, I don't recall. I know that Spencer is his last name, obviously.
Hal Spencer.
Hal, that's right. Yeah, they call him Hal sometimes.
And he's a part of that 12-man team as well. You got Michael Pena, who's another one of the soldiers on his team. You have, you're also introduced to Rob Riggle.
Who we've already heard how fond you are of his apparently stage name.
Rob Riggle plays Lieutenant Colonel Bowers, which oddly enough, we were talking about this yesterday.
Right.
Rob Riggle was previously a member of the Marines.
Yep.
And actually served directly under the real Colonel Bowers.
Yeah, he served under the real version of the guy that he now plays in this movie.
Yeah, which is super meta.
Yeah, that's a way mind trip.
I found like a photo of him in the military. You should definitely Google it because it's kind of weird.
Does his name tag say Private Rob Riggle?
It doesn't have his name. They don't put first name on it.
Private Riggle.
Yeah, I was going to say, I don't think that the whole name is on anything.
Private Riggle.
All right, moving on.
Riggle. You also get the introduction to William Fichtner's character, Colonel Mulholland.
Which is interesting because both Fichtner's character and Riggle's character, the characters retain the actual person's real name. But then, like, Chris Hemsworth plays a guy named Mitch Nelson, and that's not the name of the actual... Like, they made up a name for the movie. And it goes even so far into the postscript where they've got text that appears at the end of the movie that kind of gives you a little bit of a window into, after the events of the film, what happened to some of these, you know, men.
Do you happen to know the name?
It keeps the name Mitch Nelson. Let's see. The real name of the guy. I have it. Wait. Mark Nutch.
Yeah. Nutch.
So they kept the MN, but they changed what Mark to Mitch and Nutch to Nelson. So anyway, it makes me think like how many of the other guys on the squad have like the actual guy's name versus like a movie name.
It's interesting. and so in talking about the cast, because we get our introduction of the characters as the events of the first 20 minutes unfold, finding out about the events of 9/11, what happened at the two towers as well as at the Pentagon, seeing the mad chaos at the headquarters. It didn't really say where those headquarters were at,
where they were stationed.
Yeah,
Kentucky.
Okay, in Kentucky.
Fort Campbell. I think it was Fort Campbell.
But seeing the mad chaos there that day. And then them deciding that, you know, this is what was going to happen.
I always look at movies like this, just real briefly.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Based on a real story or based on real events. And I always am sitting there and I'm wondering, okay, how much of this version is based on real? Because like in the beginning of this film, for example, Mitch Nelson, which is Chris Hemsworth, his character, he has taken a desk job. He has removed himself from leadership over this cadre of soldiers to take a desk job so he can spend more time domestically in the U.S. with his family, his wife and his young daughter. His wife, by the way, who interestingly enough is played by Chris Hemsworth's actual real-life wife, Elsa Pataky. So anyway, he has a desk job, and then, of course, everything happens, and he goes in and he wants his position leading his men back rather than the desk job. And I was sitting there wondering, I wonder if the guy that his character is based on, like, was that his situation, or did they add that in for dramatic effect,
yeah,
you know, for the movie?
For me, here's the first thing that I recognize, and this could be probably a issue with typecasting, but we have seen Chris Hemsworth play Thor for a while now, and the last time he tried to play a non-Marvel character was Black Hat, and then, of course, Ghostbusters.
I was going to say, there's been quite a bit after Black Hat. I mean,
really?
Smaller roles, yeah, but
true, yeah, but like for me, seeing Chris Hemsworth do an American accent is interesting to me, because like how you are with Tom Hanks, how you talked about last week, recognizing the ins and outs of his his dialect or his accent of however he was doing, it was. And mind you, it's a feat in itself that a lot of these guys can pull them off, because like we joke on here all the time about trying to make, you know, accents and sound like so-and-so. And these guys are actually making millions of dollars doing it, so kudos to them. But I, even in his first interaction with his daughter at the very beginning, I could hear him kind of slipping a little bit on certain words. You could still hear the Australian kind of...
Sure.
So I like Chris Hemsworth. I really do. He's a very... he's very prominent when he's in the scene. He's obviously the center of focus, which it's great for that. But when he opens his mouth for characters that are not really in his, you know, wheelhouse of vocal abilities, it kind of turns me off a bit. I don't know. Am I the only one that caught any of that, or am I just?
I mean, nitpicking? It wasn't. It wasn't the worst. I've heard worse in terms of people trying to do an American accent who are not American. And I'm sure that there are people all over the world who regularly see American performers trying to tackle their accent and failing miserably. I don't think he failed
like
miserably.
Like Sir Chad Riley?
We're not going to bring that up. It was very sudden. I didn't have a dialect coach. I didn't have weeks of preparation. You know, I mean, I don't know where
I have no idea what we're talking about right now.
The beginning of the show, this show, when I adopted a British accent because I was knighted by
Spencer
Eddie.
Stick with us here, okay?
Yeah, I've heard people do it far worse.
Okay.
There were certain sound, like vocal sounds that,
yeah,
because it could, it's not too far, obviously, from, it's all English, right? Australian.
Oh, yeah.
Is an accent of the English language, so is British and Irish and Scottish, mm-hmm, and South African, you know, like whatever. But yeah, so there were some things that sounded familiar to a character like Thor. Mm. It was hard to tell, like, did he change anything about the way he makes the words?
Yeah.
You know, I see what you're saying, but I've definitely seen it done worse.
But I gotta give it to him. Perfect. I mean, if there is a more physical actor in the business currently right now, other than Chris Hemsworth, please name him, because he was very physical in this role. He was very in it. You could tell that a lot of the work that he's done on other films, as well as Marvel's Thor, he's put in the work. And you can tell in this one that a lot of what he was doing was him. It didn't seem like there was like, all right, cut, let's bring in a stunt double for this, obviously.
Sure.
He could very well do it. So I got to give him kudos. I don't think there's anybody else as physical or at that level. I mean, I'm pretty sure there are others, but like he's one of those ones that's up there at that level.
Definitely.
In my mind. Mm-hmm. So he was one of the standouts. You had Michael Shannon. Michael Shannon, although his part was minimal, I didn't think that he was going to be as small in the film as he was.
Right.
Yeah. It didn't seem like he didn't have a lot of screen time for a film being 2 hours and 20 minutes long. I wanted to see more Michael Shannon. But in the scenes that he was in...
Well, it's interesting because getting into the plot a little bit, you know, once they are deployed, once their team is selected, their cadre, their 12-man unit,
yeah,
is selected to be the one, the first one to attempt to link up with the Northern Alliance, which is an alliance of warlords in Afghanistan. They were supposed to embed with one warlord's militia fighting group. There are three prominent warlords that had formerly been allied, and now their alliance is fractured. So there's a lot of nuance that is kind of glossed over in the movie. I mean, it's referenced, but in a two-hour film, you don't have time to get into all of that. But basically, right. they essentially tell Chris Hemsworth, Mitch Nelson, that once his team is in there, they could just as easily end up in the midst of a melee between the different militia forces
as opposed to the current, as
they could against the Taliban, because whatever the falling out was, you know, was severe enough to break the alliance. And so then they get there, they're taken to a village, they're waiting for the general that they are supposed to meet up with. And as soon as they do, that general and his forces only provide six horses.
Mm-hmm.
So the team is immediately split into two. And Michael Shannon's character, Hal Spencer, is left behind in the initial village for a while. Like, he's part of the six guys that stays there. And of course, sitting there, I didn't know that was going to happen. I didn't know that the 12 guys were ever forcibly separated like that. So that, to your point, I expected more of him.
Mm-hmm.
It made sense within the story why we didn't. But it was kind of it was a little bit of a curveball, you know,
because
you're like, they're not 12 strong the whole time because they're not 12 together.
Yeah.
You know, not that they're not strong separately, but like they're not actually a force of 12 for most of the movie.
Yeah. I would say almost three quarters of the film.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So what about you, Spence? What did you think about either Chris Hemsworth's performance or Michael Shannon's?
I saw both of them. It was harder to deal with Rob Riggle, actually, because I just saw him. He didn't even say anything. Like, when
we're gonna go there. We're gonna go there. All right, we're gonna go there.
Spencer has opened the door.
He has opened Pandora's box.
Go for it.
So here's the thing with Rob Riggle.
You really like saying his name,
Rob Riggle. That's the only thing I like about the guy, because I'm gonna be honest. I'm not a big fan of him. Every time I've seen him in something, whether if it's even comedic or commercials, because if you don't know who Rob Riggle is, just go look at a Kentucky Fried Chicken commercial. He's one of the Colonel Sanders. So just look at those. But I don't see him as a serious actor. I look at him and I think, okay, Hangover. Okay, Step Brothers. I look at him and I see the comedic films that he's done. And then I come to find out, oh, he's in 12 Strong. Is Will Ferrell going to pop up too? Is Will Ferrell like the general? Is, you know, Adam Sandler one of the lieutenants in the army?
Wow.
I'm just, in my mind, I don't see Rob Riggle as a serious performer.
Okay, wait a minute, though. Will Ferrell and Adam Sandler have both done serious roles before and done them well.
True. Very true.
Just saying.
Rob Riggle. That's all I got to say. Just Rob Riggle.
So nothing.
So, Spencer, you were distracted by his presence.
Yeah, it was just a little distracting. But
a little?
Little.
I got
it. Well, and honestly...
He's not in it that much.
When you first meet him, like, you don't know how much the character's going to be in the story. You
right.
Don't, yeah. You don't know how much attention to pay to that character.
True.
Yeah, so...
Because he does. I mean, he's... Initially, I mean, he's their primary commander in Kentucky, you know, in the base. But then he does go with them to Uzbekistan.
Which was really interesting. I thought... I was like, okay... All right, they're giving RR a real, not prominent, but a more prominent than what would have been just a simple side character role in this film. And I mean, I guess he did all right. I don't know. I felt like he had a penis joke in the back pocket somewhere that he was just waiting to use.
Okay, but he didn't.
He didn't, but it's like the nature of the guy. It's like I expected him to say do something ridiculous that he normally does in his movies.
Wow. Sounds like a personal issue.
It does.
With you.
It really does.
There was nothing within the context of the scenes that ever indicated that was going to be happening.
Chad, did you have a problem with his performance at all?
I did not.
No, I
didn't. I also didn't find him too distracting because he's in the trailer. Like, you know that he's going to be
really?
In the film.
I didn't.
Yes.
see that.
Yes, he at okay. least his face. I think he says something in the trailer, but at least I was aware that he was in the
movie. Are you sure you weren't watching a KFC commercial?
I'm positive.
Okay,
just because he'd have the glasses and the white hair and the goatee thing and the.
Chad's got a point, man.
Very distinctive.
Very distinctive.
So yeah, it didn't bother me. I did have a little uncertainty. In the sense of like the power dynamic that was on display, the first scene that you see him in, essentially Mitch, played by Chris Hemsworth, is wanting control, wanting to be put back in a leadership position over his field team after he's just, by his own request, been transferred to an office job. And there's tension between the two of them. And I was sitting there thinking, I hope that this doesn't get too much of the screen time because I am here. I know it's kind of just stereotypical dude, but like I'm here to see guys on horseback fighting against tanks. That's what the trailer showed me. And I think that is remarkably terrifying to consider being a guy on horseback fighting a tank or multiple tanks and mortars and everything. And that was very compelling to me. As dangerous as that situation is, I wanted to see like, how in the world do you do that? How do you fight that way? And then with the whole Rob Riggle thing, I was not sure why. I wasn't sure how much emphasis it was going to have in the story. Like, are they going to play up this turf war? You know, like just that level of tension is not why I came to see the film.
You're talking about the tension at the beginning of the
to layer it in, like the power structure tension. Yeah. Like, I'd rather see them all getting along. And see the tension in the actual zone of fighting.
And, I mean, okay, immaturity aside, I think the amount of screen time that he had was perfect for me to maintain the fact that I didn't have to worry about seeing him really try to move into a territory I'm not used to seeing him in. So I think the amount of screen time he had was good because it kept my mindset at a limit of recognizing him more prominently in the film. Because if I would have made a parallel between this film, which is a very solemn and very, you know, engaging story about a covert mission that nobody had ever heard about until a few years ago, and I was to make that synonymous with Rob Riggle, I don't think I would have been able to take the film seriously. But for the amount of screen time that he has, and the performance he does deliver, I can probably admit that it was an okay job.
Honestly, most of the time he's just standing there. The very first scene, he has most of his lines come in the first scene that he's in.
That's true.
Other scenes that he's in, he hardly talks at all. He's a presence, but he's not the decision maker.
How do we feel about Michael Pena's character? Michael Pena being one of the 12 soldiers that went out into the desert to Spence?
I didn't have any real problem with him. I like seeing him in things, so I was happy to see him.
And this is a question I'm posing to you too, because in my mind, I look at Michael Pena, and not in the similarity as Rob Riggle, but I look at Michael Pena, and I tend to see like this similar persona, so to speak, on a very small level. But there seems to be a little bit of a similarity that he plays to every time he does most of his roles, even if it's a spicy or sassy individual who really has like a bite back when he talks to people. And, you know, it's not as prominent in certain films like Ant-Man or anything, but like I'm thinking Crash is one where he has that mindset. There's been other films that he's done, you know, where he has that same particular type of back and forth with people. And in this one, it wasn't like super obvious, but there was a little bit of it, like at the very beginning when he's going back and forth with Chris Hemsworth character. There's a little bit of that bite that he has when he talks. And I was hoping that it wasn't something that I was going to see throughout the film. And I didn't think I really recognized it, but that's why I'm asking you guys if it was something you guys had noticed or if it was anything that you guys had caught. And
I mean, I think that you hire Michael.
Give me my
Pena.
Mug back. That's my
You hire him for a reason. He's a character actor, and he's a good one. He's an enjoyable character actor. And a film that has all of this warfare and is tied to such a still recent event that affected, impacted millions of people.
Yeah.
Especially in the target audience, which, let's be honest, the target audience for this film is America specifically. It's going to play in other theaters around the world, but it's this is a story about American soldiers.
It's bread and
bringing
butter
the fight
be
overseas.
The
like, I, yeah. it's it, they don't spend a whole lot of time. Mm-mm. There are some vague references to the nuances of, you know, how the region of Afghanistan has been at war for millennia. And different empires have tried to go in there and take over and settle things, and it always doesn't work. And, like, you know, there are some elements that you start to at least become aware of, if not appreciate the complexity of the interplay of powers outside of Afghanistan that are playing in Afghanistan against each other, and even the plight of the Afghani people who have been essentially lorded over by the Taliban at this point for, you know, many, many years. And some of the freedoms that they enjoyed previously in previous decades have been banned, and people are killed for going against the Taliban's enforcement of the law. So, you know, there's definitely all that to say. It is definitely made for an American audience. It's not a movie that's made to respect all of those tensions and nuances. There's not nearly enough time to do that. And so in a movie that's, you know, for an American audience about American soldiers overseas fighting the war on terror, you know, taking the fight to the enemy and all of that, all of the violence that you see needs to have some kind of an outlet for the tension. And so you would want a character, whether or not it's true to life, who knows? You want a character on screen who can provide some of that levity and likability of like a normal guy who is cracking a joke every now and again or easing tension somehow.
Yeah.
And Michael Peña is a great choice for that.
That's true. And he does. He does a really good job of shining as the all-American individual, you know, in that group. Being the mouthpiece, if you will, because not everybody else really has an opportunity to shine in terms of talking and dialogue and whatnot. But when Michael Peña really does step into the in the front of the camera and, you know, delivers a line, it is as if speaking of the whole crew. So
sure. Well, and you've got, I mean, you've got your typical scene where the leader doesn't want to force his guys to do something very dangerous, and Michael Peña's character is the one that says, "Just tell us to do it. We'll do it. You're the leader. Like, don't overthink this. Just tell us to do it.
Yeah, just we'll order us. Give us the order.
That's what we're all here for."
One of the outstanding performances in this film was from the actual General Dostum, that is plays the militia leader that the American troops are sent to go and aid, which is played by Navid Negaban. And I'm probably
sure that it's pronounced differently, but we'll it's fine. Well,
he was
phenomenal.
He was
really great.
His ability to translate, you know, war torn and just tired but still dedicated to his cause, translating that on screen was flawless in just about every opportunity he had the opportunity to show it. And I had no idea that he had such an extensive. I mean, obviously, I knew he had done other things prior to this, but his whole career is pretty extensive. He's been an American Sniper. Mm-hmm. He was actually in Homeland, the series.
Yep.
He was in 24. And quick little nugget, he's actually going to play the Sultan in the upcoming Aladdin film.
I just saw that. Interesting. That's going to be interesting.
That's going to be really cool.
On that note, though, it's interesting because the way the story flow works, he's basically the second lead. He is the second lead of the after Chris Hemsworth. Now, American moviegoers, he's not a recognizable face necessarily in terms of like, well, okay, let's go ahead and like name drop Michael Shannon or Michael Peña. But like this guy, Navid, he is very much the second lead of the film. He's in many of the scenes, and a lot of the more interesting conversations occur between his character and Chris Hemsworth's character.
Yeah. And they're great scenes. It's very much a veteran warrior speaking to a non-veteran warrior, if you will, having that mindset and that mentality of, you know, you could learn a thing or two from me. I'm going to string you around a bit. But in that instance, I still care about your well-being, and I want you to learn and value the things that I value and learned. What did you think, Spence, of the actor and the characters?
Oh, I think, like, out of, like, most of the movie, like, I enjoyed the scenes where it was just Chris Hemsworth and him talking to each other.
Mm.
Because they had, like, really good chemistry going on.
They did.
Yeah.
I thought it was really interesting bringing in somebody like him whom, and like I said, to speak to Chad's point, unless you were somebody who was an avid watcher of 24 or somebody who had seen Homeland, this face is probably, or even seen American Sniper, this face is probably somebody you're not too familiar with seeing films. But bringing in somebody like that and playing a role as pivotal as this, because you knew this character was going to get a lot of screen time, knowing the role that he carried, it was a really great gamble for me in my mind, because I had no clue. I mean, if I would have seen, you know, the credits of it prior to seeing the film and like, okay, who's playing, you know, the other guy opposite of Chris Hemsworth, and looked at that name, I'm like, okay, from his credits, it looks like, no offense to the character or the actor, he's a phenomenal character, or he's a phenomenal performer, but it looks like he's pretty much been typecasted in a lot of those
absolutely roles. Yeah. I mean, that's undoubtedly been the case for him.
Yeah. And so I would have figured, okay, well, we've seen a lot of that. And
I think on, to go a little meta on this, Spencer, yeah, you brought up an excellent point about what was going through your mind, what goes through your mind when you see films like this, mm-hmm, you know, where it's like, well, that's all great. You show these, you know, like heart-wrenching, but hopefully victorious war moment, like in the midst of battle stories, and then you drop it and you don't talk about what happens to those people when they come home, what we do or do not do to appreciate their service and meet their needs. And I loved it when you brought that up the other day. I think it's a super important, I think it's very timely as well, because I mean, there's a lot of news right now about the wait times at VA clinics and hospitals, mm-hmm, and the lack of appropriate urgency.
Mm. Yeah.
For a care plan for serious chronic illnesses and injuries, that just the bandwidth either doesn't exist or there's wild mismanagement going on. Obviously, yeah, we've seen things in the recent past as well. Not to dog on the VA, but
no,
there's obviously a lot that's not working as well as it should. And so it's easy to glorify these, you know, the heroic moment and forget about, oh, but these guys have lives afterward, and yeah, what happens after this moment. But I think on the same level, or on a related level, in terms of marketing a Hollywood film, which this was wide release, it wasn't particularly big budget. I mean, it's, you know, Jerry Bruckheimer,
yeah,
produced, and some big name stars in it, but it wasn't, you know, a summer blockbuster kind of a budget.
No.
And honestly, in terms of if you were just trying to tell people before they went to the theater, this is what the story's about, it should have been those two guys as the leads of the film. And how compelling would it be if we could get a Hollywood film like this based on a real life story with those two guys as your leads? And if that proved compelling to the general movie viewing audience to get them into the seats to watch it. But instead, you've got to market Michael Shannon, Michael Pena, you know, some other, Rob Riggle. You've got to show other faces when really they do not have the stature in this film that the Dostum character, the actor Navid has. So it would be great, you know, looking forward to other stories in this vein or in other veins, like to show, no, that this guy is clearly a very accomplished professional actor who's really good at his job.
Yeah.
And essentially, he holds a lot of the emotional weight of this movie as well.
Oh, a ton of
you
the
don't,
emotional
You
weight.
Don't know that right off the bat.
Mm-mm.
It comes up about 2/3 of the way through the film when he explains his motivation and what has happened to him in the past to bring him to this level of being a militia leader / warlord against the Taliban.
Yeah.
And But when he brings it, he brings it.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
So there's no reason why he shouldn't have been billed as the second lead of this film, because he is.
And I think to what you're saying, just to piggyback on that, I think for the fact that because it was marketed prominently to the American audience, and for the fact of the subject matter, having the more notable names have top billing, because we saw this with like Baby Driver, with like John Bernthal having top billing, yet John Bernthal's only at the first 15, 20 minutes of the film.
Sure.
And we've seen it with other films, and it's just, you know, the name that sells. It's the names that sell. And sadly, in marketing, you know, that's what you want. You know, you obviously know this more than I would. I'm just speaking in terms of just recognition of information, but the names that are the ones that sell. So if you get somebody like, you know, Ryan Reynolds to play, you know, a quick cameo role as a cook or something, I would kid you not that he would probably have top billing in this film just sure. because people recognize the name. Mm-hmm. And it's sad that a performer who has a history in Hollywood, who has a vast history of probably stellar performances. I personally haven't seen Homeland, but I'm pretty sure that his performance in those episodes, as well as in the episodes with 24 and all that, were phenomenal. If had the politics of Hollywood, let's go with that, the politics of Hollywood not have played a role in this, I honestly would have believed that putting him in top billing.
Well, I would say the politics of marketing.
Marketing as well, yeah.
It's not, I mean, they cast him, right?
Yes.
And the portion, like the number of lines he has, the number of scenes that he's in, the weight, the narrative weight that they give to his character is significant.
Yeah.
And appropriately so. I think that it's important to note, looking toward the future, we should be able to get to a point where it's not bad marketing to put him side by side with Chris Hemsworth as the main characters of the movie that they are the main characters of, you know? So, because, I mean, as we said before, we were all expecting more screen time for Michael Shannon. Not that he did a bad job.
No.
Or that you needed more from his character necessarily, minus maybe some closure, which we can talk about in a moment.
Let's
but
talk about that later.
You expect that he's going to be in it a lot more than he is because of the amount that they kind of marketed his presence in the film. But, I mean, appropriately so, the General Dostum character has... I would say he probably has 40% of the lines in the movie.
Oh, no doubt.
In terms of like duration of time talking.
Yeah, I was going to say it's not so much of how much he says, but in the amount of time that he takes up delivering those lines. Because there are certain times where he delivers a line, he pauses, and then he delivers a little bit more of the next line. But it's the precise execution and delivery of those lines that really make his performance stand out. Mm. And speaking of General Dostum and the area of where the events take place, one of the other highlights of the film is the cinematography. Like,
for sure,
really good.
If I've never traveled to Afghanistan or any part of the world in that particular area, but after seeing this film, I was thinking, I'm like, if this is what it looks like, I mean, it's beautiful. Like the landscape and the formations of the rocks and the mountains and the hills, it was phenomenal.
Well, I have some good news for you.
Uh-oh.
Most of the film was produced in New Mexico.
In New Mexico.
So
you can go there.
Is this Afghanistan?
However, I mean, it was filmed there for a reason, and that's because of, you know, it's the closest correlation that in terms of a safe space to film a Hollywood movie.
True.
It's the closest correlation that we've got access to, or that Hollywood has access to. But I mean, it was very beautiful, and not only the landscape being beautiful, but the cinematography itself was beautiful. I'm glad we're on the subject, because one of the things I said immediately after the movie over chimichangas was the horse work, the choreography and stunt work with the horses was fantastic. Like, I was so impressed with how seemingly authentic. I mean, I've never choreographed battles between tanks and horses, you know, but I mean, it was like, I believed every moment of the horses charging or knowing when to stay still. Or, I mean, it was just, it was so impressive. I mean, you hear about it either in times past or in modern days, horses that are bred and trained as war horses.
Yeah.
And the control that they can show in the face of terrifying circumstances where, you know, normal, like a wild stallion would buck and turn away and mm-hmm. probably harm your own troops and everything. But the discipline of war horses and everything, I mean, it's not really explained in the movie, but it's on display in the movie. And also, I gave special props in our chimichanga conversation to the cinematography around.
We might have
some
to make
the...
that a regular thing, our chimichanga talks, and just like midweek chimichanga talks.
Maybe. But the cinematography around the helicopters, and specifically the way that the air moves, like immediately above and below the rotor blades. It was beautiful to see.
Yeah, you can tell they had access to a lot of top quality equipment for this film, whether it was the horses or, like you said, the helicopters, because they didn't just have the helicopters, but they had expert, you know, pilots for these helicopters to make every single one of those scenes look just perfect. And in all honesty, I mean, I know it's difficult to achieve certain things like that, but in the way these scenes unfolded with the work with the helicopters and following that, even following the helicopters in the formations that they were, you know, flying in over all these hills and mountains. And it was really, and it's interesting because I had said this last night at our chimichanga talks. One of the things that was interesting was that I was so busy focusing on the logistical aspect of the performances and, you know, and the timing and the continuity and the consistency of certain things and information that I missed out on the unique beauty of the things that you caught. Because after the fact, after you said it, I was like, you know what? You're right. Like, that was actually really well done. And it was, you know, beyond well done. It was expertly done. But yeah, now that I'm looking back at it, like all that work, like you said, with the horses and with the helicopters, it was very like precise.
Even the battle sequences, some of them went on far longer than you typically see even in a war movie, because it's hard to choreograph all the sight lines and the blood packs and the explosions and whatever. Obviously, you've got a series of cuts to make that happen, but
yeah,
you typically do not see battle sequences that go on as long as some of these do, which does a lot more as an audience member to help you feel the intensity of an engagement like that.
Yeah.
Obviously, if you are a veteran listening and you've experienced this, you know, real time, you should know that some of these battle sequences go on for a while.
Yeah.
You know, if it would disturb you and kick something up from, you know, your memory or whatever, you know, you're probably already well aware of the need to kind of guard yourself from content that, you know, might take you back to a dark place. But there are a few battle sequences that go on for quite a while in this film. They're not overly bloody and gory, but they are long.
And they are, I mean, they're not bloody or gory, but they are graphic in the nature of how the events transpire on the battlefield, in all honesty. What did you think about all the work that was done, aside from like the cinematography and whatnot? Was there anything that stuck out for you as well?
Okay, there's a part where, like, in this battle, people are getting shot at, and like, you'd see blood spatter out. And like, that was another part where my brain stopped. It's like, if people were shot, would it normally splatter out like that? Because I don't think so.
So Spencer was looking at the logistics of the blood. So whoever did their blood and their squibs.
Well, because, like, you know how you see like high speed footage of like a sneeze and like it's like got so much more spittle in it than like you would see like at regular speed. Well, sometimes I'm thinking like the same thing for blood. Like, you got a bullet. Those go
Is this
really
from
fast.
Firsthand experience? I'm just wondering, like, you seem
firsthand
very invested.
Experience of me watching videos of people sneezing on YouTube.
Okay, I'll take that. No, I didn't
Point
even
taken.
Honestly, I didn't even notice that. What exactly is it that you?
No, it's just like it was super visible.
It
like,
was very I totally see your point.
Like I was like, I don't know if I should see that. Is the thing.
Yeah, if in real life.
Yeah.
If that's what it looks like.
Yeah.
when somebody is shot.
Because I know we have a lot of blood in our bodies, but I don't think we have that much.
I don't know. I think, yeah. I just that's an interesting point. I mean, and I'm pretty sure you're right. I didn't pay attention to that particular aspect. I wasn't like pulling out my measuring tape, like, so the blood spitter went right here.
Hey, I warned you, war movies send me into weird mental spaces.
And I'm glad that those mental spaces are coming back down to earth. So, okay, so aside from the blood spatter, was there anything else that stuck out to you?
Other things? No, it's just like, was shot really well. And I was really stuck on the blood for like, it would be sad if I really got into how long I was thinking about that. So let's move on.
Something from a story standpoint that was remarkable to me was the duration of this campaign. There is obviously the attacks on the World Trade Center and other places, the Pentagon, et cetera, occurred in September. And Afghanistan is Northern Hemisphere, so as you go further toward the new year, it's winter time. And so there's a big push to accomplish all of these seemingly impossible tasks that the analysts themselves have assumed would take months or even years to accomplish. And they, at first, the powers that be give Nelson, Chris Hemsworth's character, 6 weeks to accomplish this. Or they in his interview, for whether or not his crew is going to get the job, they say, you know, you're going to have 6 weeks for this. And he corrects them and he says, no, we're going to have 3 weeks because winter is going to set in after about 3 weeks. And if winter sets in and we haven't made this advancement, it's not going to happen. We don't have 6 weeks. And that was something that impressed them. They said, actually, yeah, you're right.
Yeah.
And so then they deploy them into the field, and there's kind of every, 5 to 10 minutes in the movie, you get almost like a timestamp of how many days it's been.
Yeah.
You know, kind of the ticking time bomb sort of mechanic in terms of the story mechanic. Yeah. But again, I was sitting there wondering like, okay, logically that makes a lot of sense.
Yeah.
That they're deployed in the late fall, heading into the winter. Winters can be rough and very cold, so if they don't make progress faster than expected, they're not going to make progress.
Yeah.
Right? So I'm like, logistically, in my mind, that checks out. But I don't know for the actual horse soldiers and the militia. Like, did they actually do this in 3 weeks? I don't know.
Which all goes back to
I actually want to kind of go back and read the book.
Yeah, which all goes back to the based on, you know, real events.
Right.
And for me, so here's the thing. Because I thought that was really interesting, creating that ticker at the bottom, that counted down. Because you obviously knew when Chris Hemsworth's character speaks to his troops, his soldiers, he tells them, you know, we got 21 days, 3 weeks. And the countdown is at the bottom, you know, 4 days in the country, 7 days in the country, 10 days in the country.
And they go above 21. I mean, there's like 23 or like whatever. But still, like, did it actually happen that quickly? I don't know.
I think it did, because I was looking into like some of like the book's history.
Yeah.
And they were talking about how it was called the declassified story and how it was actually declassified in 2001, like November. Oh. So I think that would have had to have been.
So it was
roughly,
like, immediately declassified.
Yeah.
Oh, that takes some of the luster off of that word. But it's
good job, Spencer.
Interesting, because but to your point, they had to have done it that fast because it would have just happened and just been declassified.
Yeah.
So I think it matches up.
Wow.
Interesting.
I mean, that's extraordinary. Seeing what they were up against,
yeah,
or a depiction of what they were up against, and hearing, obviously, through other films, books, news stories, newspapers, whatever.
Articles online.
How challenging the environment is. Not the natural environment, that's challenging too, but the political environment. All of the, like, the minefields and the different external country interests at play still in that country, and including ours, you know, all of it, you know, just to hear all of the complexity and think you have to do all of this, not even knowing if you can trust the people that you're with, that you've been embedded with, who have already split your team in two right off the bat, like at the get jump, right? Like there was potential for a lot to not go right.
Yeah, because you're made aware very early on in their mission that there's already a price on the heads of the American soldiers, and so if they were brought in, they would obviously get paid for it, whether or not if they were dead or alive. So that's established early on in their mission. Here's the thing. For me, the back and forth. So one of my gripes about the film, and in terms of the story delivery, was how it constantly went back and forth from the actual fighting that was happening with the six that went out with the General Dostum and the six that were still back at the home base of the militia, which they so ironically called the Alamo.
Right.
One of the things that I kind of began to see similarities to, I was watching it, and the first thing that came to my mind as we were just looking at, oh, they're walking around, they're looking at the stuff that the guys are trying to sell, there's things like that, I immediately got like reminiscent of Jarhead. I don't know if you guys had seen Jarhead.
Yeah, it's been a while, but yeah, I did see it.
Jarhead was extremely boring. And it was marketed as this really big, you know, war American military film type thing, and then you see it and nothing happens.
It's like, really more about the psychology of the main character, but that's a digression. But yes.
So I was hoping it wasn't going in that direction, but thankfully after about hour, you know, midway through the second hour, it started focusing more because of the switch with the six going to meet up with the other group.
They reintegrate at some point, yeah.
But I think in that lull,
they finally get horses and they have to like go the entire distance to catch up with, you know, where the militia now is.
But in that small lull of about probably 30, 45 minutes, I was kind of getting those vibes. But thankfully it transitioned out of that real quick. But that, for me, that was one of the minor things that I noticed in the middle of the film. Just because it is 2 hours and 20 minutes long. The film is long. So obviously when it comes to most films that are this long, it's kind of difficult maintaining attentions and whatnot throughout the entire film. Huh. What?
I didn't realize it was that long. Yeah. It did not feel that long to me.
Didn't feel that long either. Yeah. But I knew that it was going in, but it doesn't feel, I don't think that it feels that long. It's not a movie that feels like it drags.
Yeah.
Hmm. It just, for me, I saw it because of that particular part. That particular part like kind of threw me for a loop, but. That's just me.
Thankfully, they don't spend too much time with the group that's left behind. You check in with them a couple of different moments, and there's a whole sub-story involving a young boy who is guarding them, essentially. And you know, and that was another really good positive element, you know, the way that they rounded that storyline out.
Felt, if it actually happened.
Felt very fulfilling. But I do want to talk, in terms of griping, I do want to talk about promises that you make, this is any story, promises that you make in the beginning that you never fulfill in the ending. And it sounds weird to use the word promise because the context of this comment is when the men are deployed, you see some of them interacting with their wives and children and how the departure sequence goes and how there are different ways that people respond, right? So... Yeah. Chris Hemsworth, he and his wife have a quiet conversation while they're sleeping in bed and their daughter is sleeping in the bed beside them. And she wants him to say that he's going to come home. And he says, well, essentially that's jinxing things. You don't say that. And she said, but I need to hear it. So you get that moment between them. You get Michael Peña and his character's wife. She's cleaning the oven and the kids are rowdy in the other room. And she has a stance of, I know what I signed up for, but the kids don't. So you need to spend your time with them.
Yeah.
I'm going to keep cleaning. And then she has a moment of tears when he leaves the room. And then you've got Michael Shannon's character, Hal Spencer,
Yeesh.
Who's packing up his stuff in the garage. Yeah. And his wife straight up tells him, what did she say?
He says, I love you. And she says, I'll love you when you get
I'll
home.
Love you when you get back.
Oh, yeah.
I mean, that is just like, you're sitting in the theater like, wow, that's like the heart, the guts, the everything. And then his son comes in and has major attitude with him too.
Because then she even says, you need to talk to him. I'm not going to do your dirty work for you.
Yes.
And she doesn't even wait till he's ready. She sends him into the garage.
Immediately. The son, yeah. And I mean, it was very difficult. And so when I say the word promise, I say what I mean by that is, each of those three storylines needs to have some closure at the end. You've opened a door, which is the promise.
Yeah.
You've opened a door of a story thread and you need to tie it off at the end somehow. And not all of those threads are tied off, and it's not because the guys don't come back. It's because they just didn't put that into the end of the movie, which was, I was disappointed.
That was crazy to me that they did not come back to that, because that was such a thing. Like, when I first saw it, I was like, ooh, I hope your husband does not die, because that would be terrible. I want to see how you're going to deal with whatever happens at the end of the movie.
Right.
And then it just cuts to credits. And I was like, what? Like,
yeah.
You're missing part of the end of your movie.
Because you remember it as an audience. Like, you remember, you put a pin in that thing, and you're like, okay, they better bring that back around, because that was ugly.
Yeah.
That was crazy.
And this is something that happens actually frequently in not well-developed stories of films. This is one of those things that you tend to run across, where you find a plot point, or you find an element of the film where you're hoping that the resolution happens before the film closes out. And sadly, in this particular film, there was two moments. And I was on the same page as both of you guys, because I was like, dude, that was harsh. You know,
I mean, it's brutal. You don't even know these people very well yet. And you're like, dang, that was bad.
I was even, and mind you, this is bad that it was, obviously, since it's based off of real life events. But I was actually hoping something would happen to Michael Shannon's character, so that we could go back to the wife, and so that she could like feel bad or something. So there was like a, you know, ha, back at you kind of thing.
Well, I mean, something does happen to his character.
True.
We just don't get to see the full closing of that story thread.
Exactly. And so it's, like I said, I would have taken over seeing that much, because it's not very long, but there is a good amount of time spent on Chris Hemsworth looking at his family through the window, and then they get excited, and then they run in, and it doesn't really linger long. But I would have opted for like splitting that up, even in this short amount of that time, splitting it up to the other two, and you know, showing the resolution of that, even if it's just without words.
Well, especially because somewhere in the middle of the movie, in Spencer's favorite scene with Donald Rumsfeld's speech, there it does cut away from Afghanistan and goes back to the wives. The wives are all watching Donald Rumsfeld speak. So essentially what happens in the midst of this movie is Rumsfeld himself emails Chris Hemsworth, Mitch Nelson. He emails him. Donald Rumsfeld, Secretary of Defense, emails this guy out in Afghanistan and basically says, you're taking too long, get a move on something that's already basically impossible, right? Get a move on, you need to move faster. And so then through his comms guy, Nelson writes an email back. And what? You're led to believe that this email then Donald Rumsfeld reads on the White House lawn or somewhere, and he reads the actual email. And so the wives then are sitting in a room together watching this, trying to figure out which of their husbands composed that email to Donald Rumsfeld.
Yeah.
And like all the three wives that you met earlier are there. And that's a moment in the midst of everything where the screenwriter, the director, everybody, the powers that be, they're reminding you, oh, this thread still exists. But then by the end of the movie, it doesn't exist anymore.
Yeah, that's weird.
For all of them, you know, it doesn't exist. You only get to see Nelson and his wife. I don't think, you don't even see Michael Peña's character and his wife, do you? I don't recall seeing them reunite.
No.
So, yeah, it's just like, but you reminded us in the middle of the film that this is an open item. Like, it's an open subject.
The only character who gets resolution with their families is Chris Hemsworth. Yeah. That's it.
Yeah. Which is just, that's just shoddy ending. You're not ending it well, because you're not ending all of it. You're not giving closure for everything that you opened.
Well, and obviously you're upset by this, Chad, as well, but I think in terms of story writing and screenwriting, you probably could say it better than I can, but it's about cyclical logic, you know, in terms of you create an incident with a character early on, you come to resolution with that particular instance so that you give the audience closure, you give the audience that same satisfying resolution. And it's not, I mean, even if it's, you know, you send somebody off to war and they end up passing with, you know, thoughts of family or things of that nature, you give closure to that, you allow that story to end. This is one of those instances where, I mean, unless we find out where the families are currently and we're like, what did he say, what did you tell him when he got home,
right?
You know, I don't think that's feasible. So, you know, it leaves this. I mean, because I don't think there's going to be a part two. I'm just saying. I don't think there's going to be a sequel.
Well, and it's possible that they filmed things and left them on the cutting room floor because they're like, well, it's already over 2 hours and we don't want to cut any of the military action parts, so we'll cut. But it's just that wherever that decision happened, it was a mistake.
Yes, yeah. Most definitely. I mean, I would have. It would have been fine if they added like another 6 minutes to this movie to like.
Yeah, wrap it's already up. Above 2 hours, right? So fine, at least finish it.
Yeah, proper ending, people.
Finish what you started.
In terms of what this film envelops, and we've kind of touched on this a little bit, but it is kind of a sore subject, and it is something that has been brought back into the attention with certain mediums like The Punisher, the television series The Punisher and whatnot. One of the things that Spencer mentioned earlier was the fact of why he doesn't like war films. And in particular, this film doesn't really speak towards that at all either. But one of the things that Spencer was saying was about how the reality of what happens after the fact is just as important as what happens during the fact. And I know we talked about this back at over Chimichangas.
Yeah.
But you were saying something, because this was a real fiery issue for you when we were talking about it. But can you kind of speak a little bit more towards why it is that you feel it's so necessary to continue the story, or actually even give more information about after the fact, the whole truth in the aftermath as opposed to just the battle part?
Well, because it's people's lives. Like, that's really it. Their lives is not, like, it's not a war. They do stuff before and after it. And I don't know, I just feel like it's a disservice to just, like, hyper-focus on one thing and then not, like, realize that these are real people who have, you know, lives that, like, exist in America and not just whatever war we're fighting currently. But, yeah, I'm trying not to go on a rant
here. No, I mean, that's why I'm throwing it in your court, because I want to hear, like, what it is exactly that fires you up about it. Like, okay, I'm just going to play devil's advocate for a second here, and I'm going to, you know, kind of step into this role. For me, the war film seemed to be just good enough. Knowing what else about the battle, knowing what happened there, that's all the amount I need to know. Why should I be interested in what happens after the fact? The only interesting part for me that I need to know is what happened that matters to me, that impacts me. Why is everything else after the fact so important?
Because there are heroes. Like, we send these people off to war to fight in whatever battles. Like, it's just important to me, at least. I don't speak for anyone else but myself. And I'd like to know more about, like, you know, people as, like, well-rounded figures versus just, like, oh, they did this one thing. Well, they came from somewhere. Where'd they come from? They went somewhere afterwards. Where'd they go? That's just how I am.
Yeah, I think that you make a really good point. And I think that, obviously, that story is not this movie. Right. However, there's an opportunity with this movie to at least bring up those kinds of concerns. And especially because one of the characters does get seriously injured. Mm-hmm. And you're not entirely sure how things exactly wrap up with him.
Yeah.
All 12 of them make it back out. It's not too much of a spoiler to say that, because a lot of the news coverage, you know, has also mentioned that the 12 guys, miraculously, none of them were killed in action. Yeah. There during these activities. But one of them is seriously injured, and you're not sure how things work out for him. And that would be definitely at least an opportunity to explain the importance of what happens after, you know? And, Eddie, what you were bringing up with The Punisher, the Netflix series, The Punisher, the Marvel character, one of the things that we appreciated immensely about viewing that was how in-depth it goes into some of the harmful effects of war and the aftermath thereof on a person's psychology, self-worth, what they do or don't have access to in terms of job opportunities when they come back. Just how an experience like that completely shapes the rest of your life, the following trajectory of your life. And it was such a compelling in spite of all the gore that is in that piece of, you know, entertainment. You know, there's a lot that happens that's not necessarily a commentary on what happens to our soldiers after they come home from war, but it's 13 episodes, so it's a longer form story, and there are numerous opportunities within it to really go after some of those elements, like Spencer was bringing up. And it's eye-opening. It makes you think about things that we should be thinking about. Again, put the two lead characters on the poster and see if people still go see the movie, because that guy deserved top billing.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Beside Chris Hemsworth, he carried most of the weight of the story.
Yeah.
But then also make movies about, I mean, they have documentaries, you know, they do have a few documentaries, but like, make movies about what happens with soldiers when they come back from war, and make it more, I don't know, like, use your mouthpiece. Is it acceptable that people have to wait for chronic, horrific illnesses and things, that they have to wait 4 or 5 months sometimes to have their first appointment with a doctor? I can go to the ER down the street if I need to, or the urgent care clinic, you know? And be seen immediately. Obviously, you know, the financial setup and whatever, that's different. But you know, is it acceptable? Is that paradigm acceptable? You know, or is it just that we're ignorant that that even exists? If it doesn't impact our life directly, are we ignorant to the fact that many of our heroes, our veterans, aren't necessarily getting the treatment they deserve? I do think things holistically overall are better now than, say, like in the Vietnam War era. I think broadly speaking, our country learned a lot from its mistakes in regard to the treatment of veterans when they come home from war. Cause there was a lot that went wrong. And is still wrong. We still have veterans alive and not necessarily having ever received exactly the proper standard of care that we would want for a hero, you know? And some of that is the rhetoric surrounding that conflict, you know, not no longer considering them heroes because people were upset that we entered into that and did that in the first place. But, you know, I don't know, for the guy on the line, it wasn't his choice, you know, why remove certain privileges and treatments and whatever. And I think, you know, to your point again, we've learned a lot, but there's still a lot to learn.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And I think one of the blessings of this podcast is being able to reach out to a lot of unique individuals and have a lot of those voices be a part of this. And I'm pretty sure she'd be fine with me sharing this, but one of the people who's been frequently on this podcast, Val Complex, she's actually a veteran as well. She was a former Army soldier. She served, and she's one of those individuals whom, you know, in terms of needing that vet assistance and whatnot, she suffers from things like PTSD and
sure,
and so forth. And so it's still a ever growing battle, but I think, like Chad said, we're at a point where not only are we becoming more and more aware of this, and we're speaking out more and more against this, of the ill-treatment of our veterans as they come home, but it's actually starting to impact the decisions that are being made, you know, on a government level to actually alter and change and make, you know, for better, a lot of the programs that are currently in place and even creating new programs. So things like this, things like these types of conversations, like Spence, I was hoping that you were understanding the reason why I want you to talk about it is because it's a very vital part of our day-to-day conversation that we don't normally have. How many times do people in any daily conversation stop and say, you know what, how is the veteran situation going on in the United States right now? And, you know, to be honest, I'm pretty sure from our standpoint, like for myself, and I'm pretty sure, I don't know, Chad, if you know anybody who's serving or who has served and
sure,
but you know, I don't know anybody currently closely enough to be like related who is currently fighting through that process now. Aside from, you know, like we said, Valerie, but Valerie's a good friend of ours. But, you know, that type of thing of knowing and kind of suffering with them, if you will, to make those changes be a reality and hoping and praying that becomes, you know, that's the type of thing where movies like this, as great as they are to show the exploits and the bravery of our soldiers, should still drum up the conversation of, so what's next? You know, to still ask those questions of, what comes next?
Well, storytelling is very powerful, whether it's the nightly news or Hollywood or a book or a magazine or whatever. I mean, storytelling really is a powerful tool and can shape your view of reality in many cases. And it's important to make sure that certain stories that maybe have not been told very prominently, like, let's go ahead and start telling them more prominently, because you never know who might actually care who just doesn't know. Like,
right.
You could influence change in somebody's mindset, in their heart, in their how they structure their life, but not if they remain ignorant of something.
Sure. Yeah, it's very true.
Very good point.
So with that, let's go ahead and round out our conclusions of this film. Any last thoughts before we give our gratings? Any thoughts, anything? Spencer, I'm looking at you.
I just have to throw it out there because it really bothered me in the movie. But Donald Rumsfeld sending that email... Like, I was super mad because this was after, like, they had just fought.
I was sitting by the man. Like, the seat started vibrating with anger. Like, just, like, it was like a tea kettle ready to just explode.
If you haven't seen, and hopefully we'll get pictures up soon, if you haven't seen what Spencer looks like, Spencer is a large, muscular gentleman. So I can only imagine how much of a vibration that seat was
doing. Man, I mean, that tea kettle was ready to pop.
Okay, they just, like... won a battle. It was really hard. And then all of a sudden they're checking their email, the communications guy, and they're like, oh, when are you going to get off your butt and do something? And he's like standing in the middle of a battlefield. He's doing a lot. And you have the gall to not even really be up to date with what he's doing. It's like, gosh.
We were joking.
Donald Rumsfeld is going to be receiving a strongly worded Christmas card this year from Spencer.
We were saying Spencer after the fact is like, how dare you, Mr. Rumsfeld?
What did you say yesterday? I will write an email.
Oh, like, yeah, I'll write an email to Donald Rumsfeld.
I will write it because I will write an email.
Almost so 15, 16 years after the fact.
So good.
Oh, gosh.
All right. Well,
again, if you remain ignorant, then you won't have that opportunity. But now that you know, you're going to write an email.
There you go. This movie should have came with at the end, in just in case, drumsfeld41 at hotmail.com.
Oh, they would have gotten in some real trouble. That would have been amazing.
All right. Well, let's wrap this up with Chad. Why don't you give me your, is it pass or fail, and how many monocles?
It does pass. I am a big fan of movies like this. Especially when it's telling a story that I didn't know before, but that largely did take place. You know, maybe some of the details have been changed, like names. But I was fascinated basically start to finish. The cinematography was incredible. I'd give it a 3 out of 5 because it wasn't like, wow, this is such an amazing movie.
Yeah.
But it was a compelling story. It held my interest. I did not feel all 2 hours and 10 or 20 minutes of it. Of the runtime. So yeah, I would give it 3.
It passes for me. I feel like the film really conveys a beautiful and compelling story. I think the execution of the story was done nominally. I mean, it like you said, it wasn't this, you know, Saving Private Ryan type film. It wasn't this large epic. It is a compelling story that slipped my, you know, eyes in terms of seeing, I guess, since it's been declassified since November 2001, I'm like, man. Why?
Well, that's because you kept Googling horse shoulders.
That's what it was.
That's what it was.
It kept showing me shampoo horse for shoulders. Horses.
Horse and shoulders?
So you don't understand, dear listeners. He's going to Google this now after the show, and he's going to see what pops up.
Got it. The film passes, like I said, but for me, I'm going to probably give this a 2.5. Like I said, I love this story. I love what it was about. In terms of execution, there were a couple things that just really didn't sit well, and the runtime, not as much, and I would have loved to have resolution on other parts of the story that I didn't get resolution on. So, Spencer.
Interesting. I was going to go with 2.8, because I was going to go with a 3, but that ending, like... It was so obvious you should have done more.
So is that a 0.1 for each person?
Yes.
Really?
Yeah, I totally thought of that on my own.
So it passes for you, yes, and it's passed. a 2.8. All right, well, that about wraps up that review. Let us know what you thought on our Facebook page at facebook.com/filmlosophers or on our Twitter page at twitter.com/filmlosophy101. Before we go, I'm going to let you know of a couple upcoming weekend releases. You got Maze Runner, The Death Cure, the last of the trilogy of these films. Check it out this weekend, as well as, finally, the wide release of three major films that have been getting a lot of Oscar buzz, a lot of awards buzz.
Yeah, a lot of awards buzz.
You got I, Tonya, Phantom Thread, and Call Me By Your Name. So if you get a chance, check these films out. These films are the talks of the town when it comes to awards.
Yeah, they've all done the film festival circuit. Yep. They've been in limited release for a few weeks, and now they're in more theaters.
Truth. So, but yeah, this was a great conversation, guys. And like I said, these types of films, although it doesn't specifically talk about it, even though it should, these are the types of films that should start the conversations like ones that we had about what next and what comes after the fact. And I think that's a very important part of this struggle for not only the you know, warriors and the soldiers that we have currently serving, but for the whole United States altogether to understand that suffering and that, you know, battle that happens mostly, you know, in Washington. So yeah. So with that, from all of us here at the Filmlosophers, I'm Eddie.
I'm Chad.
I'm Spencer.
Class dismissed.